Then it's on.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for Friday, February 20th, and open up a work session on House Bill 2546. I'll tell you where I'm hoping to go. We have one special request for testimony that I'll call in a minute. I will then take a motion for the Dash 16 amendments. And then, I need to put the bill on the floor first, right? Do we need to move the bill first or the amendment first?
The amendment first, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and then we'll see where we go from there.
Correct.
Can I call Mr. Keeley? Is that close enough?
Yeah.
You can make it right. Please start by introducing yourself.
Okay. My name is Akili Kelly, and I'd like to thank the chair and committee for this opportunity to testify on House Bill 2546 regarding e-cigarettes. I'd like to start my testimony with an analogy. No one knows the secret Krabby Patty formula and probably never will. You guys know SpongeBob, right?
SpongeBob, yes.
Yeah,
think about it.
Though no one on SpongeBob knows it, they still love and devour the Krabby Patties. Who knows if Mr. Krabs adds nicotine to the recipe? Maybe he disguises it with condiments. None of the SpongeBob characters will ever know what they're ingesting, and they haven't shown any interest in doing so. That scenario is similar to what's going on with kids and e-cigarettes. E-cigarettes are a detriment to our society, and I believe that the corporations who produce them are deceiving their potential customers. If this product is going to be tolerated in Oregon, there needs to be some action taken to safeguard the people. That's why I've come to testify in favor of House Bill 2546 today. For my block class at school, I did a bit of research on this topic because I care a lot about the issue. I learned that e-cigarettes were started because cigarettes were going out of style due to their dangers, and cigarette companies needed a new market. According to drugabuse.gov, although unacceptably high numbers of youth continue to smoke, these numbers represent a significant decrease from peak smoking rates that were reached in late 1990s. A significant decrease in youth addiction shows that America has gradually moved away from traditional tobacco cigarettes. Because tobacco companies were realizing rapidly abating profits, the e-cigarette was invented to help to keep America smoking and big tobacco solvent. According to Dispatch.com, Philip Morris International's fourth quarter profit dropped 19% as cigarette sales fell in overseas markets. And it was hurt by foreign exchange rate for the U.S. dollar. Clearly, people around the globe were starting to realize how harmful cigarettes are. The main tactic companies such as Philip Morris use to sustain their companies is diversifying to e-cigarettes, which they advertise to children. They know that if they market it toward children, they will hook them on smoking at a young age, thereby creating lifelong consumers and possibly making smoking cool again. ABC News notes that cigarette ads may have been banned from television since 1971, but that hasn't stopped electronic cigarette makers from placing TV ads likely to be seen by children and young adults. It appalls me that the people of our nation haven't taken one step toward fixing that, and it's just shooting ourselves in the foot. There are few regulations that restrict children from purchasing e-cigarettes at a local convenience store, either despite the fact that researchers have begun to document the harms of e-cigarettes. Portland State University's researchers say that e-cigarette vapor can contain hidden formaldehyde at levels 15 times higher than regular cigarettes. Formaldehyde is a toxic chemical that can be found in germicide, pesticides, and disinfectants. NoSmoke.org revealed that electronic smoking devices do not just emit harmless water vapor. Secondhand aerosol, incorrectly called vapor by the industry from electronic smoking devices, contains nicotine, ultrafine particles, and low levels of toxins that are known to cause cancer. The exposure to such aerosols could cause respiratory problems like asthma and clog one's arteries, leading to heart attack. Propylene glycol is another ingredient found in the electronic device. If propylene glycol is heated, which it is in e-cigarettes, it changes its chemical composition, emitting traces of propylene oxide, a harmful carcinogen. E-cigarettes aren't regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, so therefore they don't have to disclose any ingredients. I am a young Oregonian who's glad for recent attempts to try to fix the e-cigarette problem. This 2015 legislature is considering several good bills, including this one, to address this problem. For instance, one bill would stop e-cigarette manufacturers from producing flavorful e-cigarettes because, as Senator Lori Moniz Anderson said, flavoring is just another way to hook people on nicotine. On February 9th of this year, a teenager in Anaheim, California, got injured at his home. The police were told by witnesses that the young man was holding an e-cigarette shortly before the explosion that maimed him. Detectives believe that the e-cigarette was the reason for the explosion. E-cigarette companies don't give any ingredients on their packages, so who knows if one of the ingredients could be explosive when overheated. You may wonder why I, an eighth grader, would care about this. It's because e-cigarettes have affected my peer group. In the spring of 2014, there was a school get-together at a local elementary school. There were a group of kids who had e-cigarettes. They asked my friends and me to try some in the woods. We, of course, politely declined their request. As they were asking us to try it, they also told us that they had bought it themselves at a convenience store in proximity of the school. At that point, my friends and I were shocked. Our jaws dropped all the way down to our knees. We couldn't believe our government, that we so heavily trust, is letting the corporations like Blue get away with selling to minors. There was another get-together about a month after the first, and this one took place at a different school. The same group of kids who initially introduced e-cigarettes to West Sylvan got more kids to join in on this act the second time. This same experience could be encountered by many other children in Oregon if there isn't action taken in this 2015 legislative session. I luckily didn't have to go through the whole peer pressure part of it. When I said no, the kids just went on to do their own thing and didn't bother me. Elsewhere, perhaps peer pressure is a realistic thing for a teenager to face in these types of situations. And being a teenager myself, I know that peer pressure is not easy to deal with. Every kid wants to be socially accepted. If we let e-cigarettes be part of the social norm, Oregonians won't see the 100% graduation rate expected in 2025. You may wonder why e-cigarettes can affect a child's academic success. Well, hypothetically, if a child is inclined to try e-cigarettes in middle school, he or she will probably also be willing to try other drugs that are considered cool in high school. Drug use will inevitably be a barrier to students who go down that path. My goal in coming before this committee is to suggest that you look at the potential consequences of e-cigarettes on our students. If banning them entirely is not an option, please make sure that kids like me do not have legal access to them. Please pass House Bill 2546. Thank you for considering my testimony.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, great job.
You did a great job. Thank you very much for coming in. Representative Notes?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move an amendment. I'd like to move that we adopt the Dash 16 amendments dated 2/13/2015.
Representative Notes moves that we adopt the Dash 16 amendments dated 2/13/15. These amendments do three things, right? They were. It takes the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments, which were technical fixes on the bill, and adds to those the requirement that OHA comes back to us in 5 years and reports on whatever information they have on e-cigarettes. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection to the amendment? So moved. Motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that House Bill 2546, as amended, be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Notes moves that House Bill 2546, as amended, with the Dash 16 amendments, be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I may. Is there any possible full consideration for the Dash 8 amendments?
You can move them if you'd like.
I would actually wouldn't mind moving them. So, Mr. Chair,
they,
I move.
Were they in OLS?
They have been,
they've
been in OLS.
Yes.
Been in OLS.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 2546.
Representative Widener moves that we move the adopt the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 2546. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative,
do you have to either have him withdraw or dispose of the other motion we were in the middle of first?
Well, I think you can put a motion, you can put an amendment on the floor with a motion on the floor. Sandy, is that?
We already voted on the other one, didn't we?
And then he moved to send it to the floor.
We voted, we did the Dash 16 into the motion. Now we had the motion for the main bill as amended. I think it's proper.
I think we're in discussion on that motion and probably the appropriate. I don't know, but I'm thinking you might
Mr.
have
Chair,
to withdraw the motion so he can make his.
Right. And
withdraw the motion to vote on House Bill 2546. I need my glasses. Or rescind the motion.
He can't do it. It's the maker of the motion.
So I have to do it?
Yeah. Well, wait a minute. I'm not sure. I'm not really sure we have to do it. So
yeah,
if we want to stand at ease and check with this.
Clerk?
With the clerk's office.
Let's stand at ease.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2557. And that work session, this is my bill. And we had a bill in judiciary. It turned out when we asked for a change in the bill in judiciary that the bill even has written was in violation of the relating to clause of its own bill. So it happened that we have a bill here with the proper relating to clause, which is also my bill, so what I'm asking the committee to do at this point.
That's my staff, that's not.
Oh. What I'm asking the committee to do at this point is to add the Dash 1 amendments to it, which gut and stuffs the bill to be something completely different inside its relating to clause, and then send it on to the Judiciary Committee without recommendation. So,
I know.
We have a script.
Yes, we do.
Yes, we do. Let's have one for the bill, too. Representative Nose?
Mr. Chair, I would like to make a motion that we move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment, which is dated February 18, 2015, for House Bill 2557.
Thank you, Representative Nose. We have a motion. Representative Nose has moved we adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 2/18/15 to House Bill 2557.
Mr. Chair, did we open a work session?
Yes,
I did.
He opened the
judiciary. Is there any discussion on the motion?
It took a long time for him to do it, but he did do it.
It's a technical.
And any objection to the motion? So moved. Can I have a motion on
Mr. Chair,
moving the bill to the floor without recommendation?
With
a subsequent referral to judiciary.
Judiciary?
Which it has anyway, yeah.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would like to make a motion that we move House Bill 2557 to judiciary.
Oh, to the floor.
To the floor.
Without recommendation.
Without recommendation, but with a passage.
And then it be moved
with
to
a subsequent motion to judiciary.
President Notes moves.
Prior reference.
We adopt House Bill 2557 as amended with the Dash 1 amendments to the floor with no recommendation, and that by prior reference it be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Is there any discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Klein?
Aye.
Representative
I'm sorry, Kenimer?
Mm-hmm.
Excuse.
Representative Dyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Whitehair?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Yes.
Chair Greenlee?
Yes. Motion carries. Bill's on its way to judiciary, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2557. Stand at ease, please. Did we hear anything?
We need to stand at ease.
Still at ease?
Yes.
We are still at ease. But if we stay at ease much longer, I'm going to open up a public hearing on another bill. Is there a discussion on your motion?
Mr. Chair, reason I have the Dash 8 amendments, it's just kind of to help with the definitions and allow some of the businesses that are there, the vape shops that are in place, to allow them. I mean, it still says no one under 18, but it allows them to actually be able to sample products in their facility and things like that, rather than having to go out and stand on the sidewalk in front of everybody. Customers can be inside when they're walking in, they're buying vape products, they're going to be doing it. And that's why I think it's appropriate for us to have this definition in there and move forward with the Dash 8 amendments in this bill.
Thank you, Representative Weiner. All I can say is we've worked out all the agreements on this bill to send it through clean with the Dash 16, so I would urge my colleagues to vote no on the amendment. It can be taken up again in the Senate, where I'm sure it will be taken up. Please call the roll.
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
No.
Representative Kinnamer?
Excused.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
No.
Representative Lively?
No.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
No.
Vice Chair Nose?
No.
Chair Greenlake?
No. Motion fails. Is there any more discussion on the main motion, the adoption of...
Do I need to make it again?
No, it's on the table.
Okay.
You can try.
Would you please call the roll?
Representative Bueller?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kettimer?
Excused.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Mills?
Aye.
Chair Greenlake?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2546 is on the way to the floor. Who would like to carry it?
I will.
Representative Taylor would like to carry it.
Jim wants to carry it.
Yeah.
You got to vote yes to get that out. I close the work session on House Bill 2546.
You should have voted yes, Jim.
Thank you, guys. I'm sorry it was a little awkward to get to.
But it was information that we needed to know. Yeah.
Yes.
I appreciate it, Chair.
You need to listen to me. That's what
you you needed to listen to me before that.
Okay. I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2363. Madam Administrator, what have we got?
House Bill 2363 adds the requirement that a treating physician document in the clinical record any seclusion alleged to have been on a mental illness, an individual with mental illness, and who is confined in a hospital or a non-hospital facility, declares an emergency effective on passage.
Would you call the first panel, please?
We have one individual, Bob Junda.
Is that true of all?
That is
all
true.
The bills?
Well, of his three bills, yes.
Which of the three bills? Let me open up all three public hearings. The other two.
2360.
Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2368. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2369. And welcome. I think this is the first time this session with us. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. It is.
Welcome, Mr. Junda.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Junda. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you for hearing these three bills today. Each one of them is a little technical in nature, so I'll try to walk through what their intention is.
We wanted to hear from her first, but we'll take you. Okay. It was a poor substitute.
I'm sorry. I'll try to live up to your expectations, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2363 has to do with the situation involved in the civil commitment process. When a person is taken into custody because they're in a mental health crisis, they are normally held in a treatment facility, oftentimes a hospital bed. It can be an emergency room or other setting. One of the problems that we are experiencing right now in our community mental health system is a lack of community psychiatric beds. So many people do end up waiting for days in emergency room, emergency departments. This is a nationwide problem. It's not just an Oregon problem. In Oregon, when a person is taken into custody, they enter into a five-day period in which they are evaluated to determine whether they should go before a judge in order to have a civil commitment hearing. And if they are recommended for that hearing and they have it, they can be formally committed to state custody and held in a hospital for treatment. During that five-day period, there's certain rules that apply to the person in terms of their care and treatment that are different than the ones that apply post-commitment. So what we're talking about in this bill are the standards for people who are being held during that five-day period. According to state law, those people are entitled to treatment in the normal, customary fashion that is provided in their community. And there is a requirement that they not be subjected to shock treatment and that any use of mechanical restraints, and those are being tied down physically, are documented. However, there is no requirement in the state statute that that episodes of seclusion are documented. And what seclusion is when a person is held in a room by themselves and they're not allowed to leave, normally with a locked door. In our administrative rules governing holds, people who are on these holds, people who are held in community hospital beds, there is a requirement that that seclusion be documented. According to Joint Commission rules, there's a requirement that these episodes be documented. But in our state statute, it doesn't specify the seclusion. We feel that that's an oversight, and that in order to make sure that there's not a sense that this particular type of intervention is being ignored or not addressed in state law, that this this bill would make that correction. Now, this is not a big step. We're not claiming that this is going to directly change practice. However, I think it does bring to light the fact that there are many people who end up in de facto isolation in emergency departments while awaiting a psychiatric bed in their hearing. And I just add that there are other efforts being made to address that problem in Oregon. This is not, we do not say this is the solution to the problem. It's far from it. However, we think that having the state law recognize the significance of seclusion and the significance being that people who are in psychiatric crisis oftentimes are that seclusion of those people can have a non-therapeutic effect to leave them all alone, all by themselves while they're responding to psychiatric emergency. So that's the purpose of House Bill 2363.
If there are any questions, yes, Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. I actually have a question. First reading the bill, it just kind of seemed like, well, isn't that already the standard of care? So two questions, just real quick. One, is this only being required by a physician, psychiatrist, somebody in health care, versus law enforcement that's in a situation where they have to confine somebody for their own safety until they can engage with proper medical care?
Representative Greenlee, Representative Hayden, this provision of law just applies to the medical profession, and so it's a requirement that that performing this intervention gets documented in the medical record, so the police don't have any responsibility during this period.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
Anybody else? I close the public hearing on House Bill 2363. Next.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, I'm testifying now on House Bill 2368. Chair Greenlich is very familiar with this topic, and I will again walk through it. Oregon law allows people to sign documents to plan for the eventuality that they may have to have medical decisions made for them when they are incapacitated, when they are mentally incapable of making those decisions for themselves. We have two different documents that allow that to happen. One is, I will call, an advance directive for healthcare, and that allows a person to plan for this circumstance. It normally is used for people who are concerned about what will happen at the end of their lives, when they may be unable to make decisions about the removal of artificial nutrition, hydration, or treatment that keeps them alive. However, that document also allows, it covers other types of medical treatment. For years, inpatient psychiatric, decisions about inpatient psychiatric care was specifically excluded from coverage in that document, but that was changed during the last two regular long sessions. And so now that healthcare directive covers the waterfront, if you will. There is another document called the Declaration for Mental Health Treatment that was created specifically to make advanced decisions about psychiatric care. And it was anticipated that it would be used for people who experience chronic mental health disorders, who understand that from time to time that their disorder may become active and render them unable to make decisions for themselves, and they would like to be able to designate another person to make that decision for them or to give some specific directions about the care that they desire. This, when it was put into place, the hope was that it might be a way to avoid unnecessary civil commitment for folks by allowing them to agree to treatment in advance, if you will, and to allow another person to have access to the records and to participate in decision-making with their psychiatrist or other mental health professional. So now we have the two documents, but what we don't have in law is any provision that says if these two documents disagree on any particular topic, which one prevails. So, for example, a person could have a regular health care directive that names their sister as a surrogate, and yet the Declaration for Mental Health Treatment might designate they want their brother to make decisions about that. But then you might come to this very same decision and have a conflict in the documents. And so what we are proposing in this bill is that because the declaration is much more specific to the particular aspects of mental health care, that it, should there be a conflict between the two documents, that the declaration of mental health treatment would prevail. I do not have a specific instance in which this has come up. It's really, again, sort of a technical adjustment.
The conflict problem is a new problem.
Correct. As a result of some changes to the healthcare directive.
Bob, did you consider the issue of which was the most recently signed as a...
Mr. Chair, coin flip. I did. That was considered. And our sense was that one of the things about the healthcare directive is that on its face and on the face of the document, it almost completely addresses, is concerned with end-of-life decision-making. And if you look at the actual document itself, it doesn't mention mental health treatment at all. And so if someone were to say, I'm going to sign one of these and take a look at it, there would be no mention at all about mental health treatment. That, whereas the declaration for mental health treatment is all about mental health treatment. It's very specific to that. One provision that's unusual about the declaration is that it only has a 3-year life from the period of signing to expiration, whereas the broader healthcare directive continues on indefinitely until it's revoked by the principal or the person who signed it.
Bob knows that the bill that we're talking about was my bill, taking out the mental health exclusion from the general rule, and it was not intended to be defining the general treatment of mental illness. It was simply allowing, in this case, say, my wife to have the power to admit me to a mental hospital if I needed to be admitted to into a psychiatric unit. I don't think these things are interfere with each other. And I would support this motion and this amendment with you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions on this? Are there any questions on this? This is a hypothetical thing, but you want to prevent ambiguity in a situation where you have these kind of crises going on. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2368. Next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm now addressing House Bill 2369. This is another one of these health law nerd kind of issues, so I apologize in advance. I was just addressing the fact that in Oregon law, we have a section of the law that deals with end-of-life decision-making. A person can sign a health care directive to give instructions about what to do when if they're incapacitated, they can't make decisions for themselves, and they have a condition that means that they're very near the end of their life, and some very, very important decisions have to be made about whether to continue them on artificial life-sustaining measures or not. There are some people who don't have family, don't have friends, or the people who know them the best are service providers because they have intellectual and developmental disabilities or other severe disabilities that have brought them within the service sector, the state-supported service sector. In recognition of that fact, there is a provision in the law that says that when a decision is made about withdrawal of life-sustaining procedures, that if that person has a case manager from the Department of Human Services, that that case manager is required to be notified by the treating physician before any action is taken to remove life-sustaining procedures. Interestingly enough, in the statute, it says that the identity of a case manager is supposed to be determined by administrative rule. However, it does not say that the steps that a case manager is supposed to take upon receiving notice should be set out in administrative rule. And what we have found as an agency is that in our role as responding to complaints of abuse or neglect of people with disabilities, that we receive anywhere from 2 to 5 complaints a year having to do with people, usually with intellectual and developmental disabilities, who are either being referred to hospice or in a hospital where there's a recommendation that artificial nutrition, hydration, or life-sustaining procedures be removed from them. And we will normally, when we receive a complaint of that sort, contact case manager if we can locate one, since there is a requirement that those case managers are contacted in order to coordinate some understanding of the situation and respond to it. What we have found is that most of the case managers who we contact really don't know what to do in these circumstances. And so what we're hoping through this bill is to require the Department of Human Services to create some administrative rules, get all the parties to the table, have a discussion, and determine some uniform standards as to how DHS should respond when one of their clients is potentially at the end of life. I'll add one other factor just from our perspective is that sometimes in the course of making decisions of this kind, a treating physician or others will make determinations about an individual's quality of life, what quality of life they may experience going forward. Sometimes there's quite a bit of disagreement between people in the service sector that serve a person either a residential provider or a case manager or other provider as to the quality of life that person experiences as opposed to a physician who really doesn't on a day-to-day basis interact with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and may have a very different opinion about that. And so one of the underlying reasons to have this notification and interaction is to make sure that that perspective of from people who know an individual, know what their life is like, and have a sense of it can be brought into the process. And also the overall recognition in the law is that in making such significant decisions about a person's life that you have a lot of heads that are involved in it rather than just relying upon one person to make the call.
Any other questions, Mr. Janda?
Yes, sure. I'm a little confused. So right now, under current law, the case manager is not involved in these decisions?
Chair Greenwood, Representative Bueller, the case manager does not have a decision-making role. The only the legal provision right now says that before an action is taken, the case manager is supposed to be notified, okay. And that's all it says. So there's a notification requirement, that requirement goes to the treating physician.
Yeah, follow up. Mm-hmm. And the intention right now is to, does the case manager then engage and give opinion that doesn't have the force of decision-making right now? How does it usually transpire?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, there is no set standard right now.
What's common practice, though?
I don't know if there is a common practice, honestly. We've seen different situations in which a case manager has referred the matter to the state office for consideration. And sometimes when they haven't done a thing, as far as we know. But I can't tell.
How does the physician know there's a case manager?
Chair Greenlick, the law says that the treating physician is supposed to make reasonable efforts to determine whether there is a case manager or not, and I think that's a case-by-case situation.
I mean, excuse me, a patient shows up and has end-of-life needs at that point. The physician doesn't necessarily know that patient has a case manager, right? I mean, if he knew the patient had a case manager, he or she, then they would, okay, need to find out who they are. But if they don't know they have a case manager, I wonder how.
And again, you're correct, and the law contemplates both for the case manager and for other family members that the treating physician, or more likely someone who's been delegated to the task, is supposed to make reasonable efforts to locate.
Is there somebody from DHS here that could comment on this situation? Oh, good. Thank you. The question is, what do you make of this whole thing? I mean, this bill particularly.
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Whiteance, and I work for the Oregon Department of Human Services, Aging and People with Disabilities. And we know that sporadically this happens where case managers receive notification. I think it puts them in a very uncomfortable position with the physicians and the decision-making in the medical community. We're not sure how we would implement this and what would be the expectation for case managers in these circumstances. It is very difficult when people don't have families that can help resolve these issues for them when they're no longer able to make the decisions.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Wait, you got a question? Yeah. Oh.
Sorry to keep on trying to clarify this. But
let's go.
So right now, by law, the physician is supposed to consult with the case manager. Is that right? Or just notify? I'm confused on.
Chair Greenlich and Representative Bueller, I think that the way that I read the legislation is it says that the case manager should be notified, not really consulted.
Okay.
But my colleague next to me is a lawyer, so.
Yeah.
Well, Jane Ellen knows what she's talking about.
Good.
But there's some requirement here for DHS to make do some rulemaking, is that? Mm-hmm. That's all I heard you say.
This bill would require them to make some rules about what a case manager should do when they receive the notification. That's the purpose of the bill.
That's what I was asking you to comment on, on the rulemaking system.
Chair Greenlich, correct. It would require us to define exactly what the case managers are supposed to do in those circumstances. And that's where we're internally struggling with what does that look like when you have a person, to be blunt, with a bachelor's degree or maybe a master's degree, but is not in a medical arena, having that discussion with a medical professional that's licensed to practice medicine in the Oregon, what does that dialogue look like?
Well, but that's true of the family member as well. I mean, I think that's the notion of this end of life decision is there are people that are going to have to help make that decision on behalf of the patient. In certain circumstances, there is no one, and the physician needs to make that. But in this case, you wouldn't imagine it's better to leave it ambiguous now rather than to try and help clarify it for a case manager. That's I think that's the crux of it.
So
my guess is the case managers are usually involved some way, and I think this might clarify that a bit.
Chair Greenlich, I'm not sure at least from the side from Aging and People with Disabilities and in brief conversations with my colleagues in developmental disabilities, it doesn't seem like it's happening often. It does happen, and people are engaged in that conversation. And there may be ways to define the language of what is your expectation of case managers in that situation versus just the leaving it to the department to create rules. So what is your expectations of us in those circumstances? And I do understand that the problem is when you have no one who's around to advocate, and Bob and I have talked about the legislation, about individuals who the medical community may say there's little value left in this life, but the case manager or others involved in that care setting or involved with that individual may say that there is still a positive quality of life.
Would it be useful for you guys to have some more conversation about this?
Chair Greenlich, always happy to talk with Bob.
I want to make sure that if we do something, it's something that you guys are comfortable with saying, okay, we can do something with that, and it might be worth doing. It would be very helpful. Who we got? Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Greenlich. Isn't there some value you have two highly trained professionals trying to make the best decision possible to have some flexibility in their decision making? This is what they're trained to do on a regular basis. I'm concerned we're being overly prescriptive here in telling them how to do their job.
Chair Greenlich, Representative Bueller, the intention here is not to be overly prescriptive, nor is it to dictate medical practice. It's really to give some direction to the case manager as to what their role is in the process. And And I think we as advocates, and particularly in our agency where we do receive these complaints, feel more comfortable if we know what the role of the case manager is. And particularly in matters of life and death, we think it's just important. And lastly, I'd just say that the desire here is not to bring one perspective, but to bring a number of people together to try to look at a situation and say, what should that role be?
Well, I was going to say, it seems to me in the usual course of this, as I remember, if there's nobody that you have a patient that's unable to communicate in this situation, and there's no agent for that patient that's known, that decision goes to the ethics committee of the hospital, doesn't it? Isn't that the usual?
Almost always.
I mean, the physician's not going to make that decision on his or her own. That will be a broader decision, at which point I assume a case manager, if there is one, on behalf of the patient will be called.
Chair Greenlick, in some places that happens, in some places it doesn't happen. In some places the quote-unquote ethics committee is one individual. I don't know if
that's not very common in most Oregon.
I don't think it is common, but it still does exist. I'll just add one other detail. I don't want to drag this out too long for you.
I think we're about done.
But there are in the world, particularly in the world of intellectual and developmental disabilities, there's great attention given to the fact that people, in those individuals, can communicate their desires and they can communicate who they trust and many other things, even though that they might be technically considered to be incapacitated to make complicated decisions. And oftentimes the people who can communicate effectively with them are the person who has provided the residential services for years or other types of services or case management. And then when that person all of a sudden ends up outside of that world, the individuals who interact with them, like the treating physician or other hospital staff, may not have that level of familiarity to interact. And so just in terms of honoring a person's individual autonomy and honoring their desires to the extent possible, sometimes that can be achieved with the person who served them for a long time. And so there's some wording that you'll see throughout law and rules that reflect that sense of that a person should be able to interact at the level they can. And so there is a valuable role for a case manager to play who can bring that perspective into the process, not to override the physician's ultimate decision or authority, but just to add more information into the process. Really, what we would anticipate is that there would be some understanding and uniformity, that the case manager would understand that this is the type of information that should be provided into the process.
Is that rulemaking responsibility going to produce a fiscal?
Chair Greenlick, the answer would be no on rulemaking. Yes. Is what we do.
Well, we'll get revenues and fiscals on these three bills and figure out where we're going with them.
Sure, sure.
Thank you very much for bringing them to us.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on 2369 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2825. Madam Administrator, will you tell us what this is about, please?
Requires the House Bill 2825, Mr. Chair and Committee, requires the Oregon Health Authority to seek out and apply for grants and gifts and contributions to fund and appropriate monies, from the general fund to pay for crisis intervention services, residential care for individuals with mental illness. It also directs OHA to convene an 11-member work group and specifies the membership composition, has an emergency clause effective on passage. We have a dash to amendment that I believe will be addressed with our witnesses.
And has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
It does, Mr. Chair.
Would you call the panel, please?
Sure. Chris Bonoff and Kevin McChesney?
Chesney.
Pardon me.
Chesney.
And there's one other that signed up.
There's one after that.
Whoever's starting, please identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. My name is Chris Bonneff. I am the executive director of the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We're a grassroots membership governed organization composed primarily of individuals and families directly affected by mental illness. I'm pleased to be here to speak in favor of this legislation, House Bill 2825. In short, what it does is create something that we term a housing development incentive fund. It would take a state investment and provide that as a 20% incentive to those treatment providers and developers who would construct housing dedicated to individuals living with mental illness, and in particular individuals living with serious mental illness. The term housing in this context is the broadest sense of the word, in that across our state we have a significant shortage of everything from high acuity licensed treatment housing all the way to very independent, what we would call supported housing. For individuals living with mental illness. And I should note, it's also for addictions. We have a significant shortage as well for housing around individuals living with addictive disorders, and in particular, a tremendous shortage for people living with co-occurring mental illness and addictive disorders. This concept came about in 2012 when NAMI Oregon, as the economy was improving, we saw the state in position to make new investments in the community mental health system after years of really holding flat on funding. We convened folks that we thought were knowledgeable and bright thinkers on our issues, and so we brought together representatives from hospital systems, from the soon-to-be-formed coordinated care organizations, from our networks, in partnership with the Oregon Residential Providers Association, and in those conversations as to what new investments should be made, where they should be directed, we all really settled again on housing as that broad sense of the term. Hospital and systems were enduring, patients who were in acute psychiatric units were enduring longer lengths of stay than was really medically appropriate because we didn't really have the step-down treatment centers. People in step-down treatment centers weren't able to really get into more independent housing when appropriate. People in independent housing really weren't able to move up into the system into short-term housing within their community setting that would allow them to really maintain their independence over the long term. And so it became clear that a common area agreement was housing. Then the question was, well, how do you pay for this, and how do you get the best return for state investments? Oftentimes in the past, the state would pay full freight for the type of environments we're talking about. But we went to the people who do the business and build these things and bring these projects together, and they essentially told us, if you give us 20%, we will find 80% of the financing elsewhere, which to us gave a pretty good return on the state investment. For every dollar in state funding, mental health funding, $4 would come from other sources. We proposed this legislation in partnership with the Residential Providers Association in 2013. Everybody thought it was a great idea. There were no money. Then there was a special session and an increase in the cigarette tax, and with that additional revenue dedicated to mental health services through an agreement process with Addictions and Mental Health Division, with NAMI, with residential providers, and with legislative oversight, $5 million was appropriated to this concept, and I'm pleased to sit here and tell you it worked. In a very short period of time, $5 million went out the door. In the process that is in a modified process that is more robust in this legislation, and that $5 million investment turned into $24.5 million in housing value across Oregon. In addition to some independent housing, affordable housing in the Portland area, there are two new respite programs that will be coming online in the Portland area, which are desperately needed alternatives to acute hospitalization and step down from acute hospitalization. But I think more importantly, there's also new independent housing going in Coos County, Curry County, Jackson Lane, and Marion counties. So it is clear that what we had intended was a pool of flexible funding that would be able to fund needed projects in various regions, particularly as the regions went through planning, the CCOs went through planning, what were the needs of people living with mental illness, that those funds would be available to develop the type of services or housing that met the regional priorities through that process. I guess it's not, as an advocate, right, I'm used to complaining about things, and I'm here to come up and tell you.
We've noticed that.
Yeah. and it's, you know, and I say that with a grain of salt because mental health care, I mean, you remind, we're coming out of a dark ages where we're, you know, you just would be grateful if you were equal with the rest of the healthcare system and complaining about what they're complaining about. But it's nice to come up and say, you know, back in 2013 when we testified on this and proposed this, it was an idea. We knew it was an idea with merit because we had a lot of support. We had people from affordable housing coming out supporting us. We had treatment providers supporting us. We had hospitals supporting us. So we knew it was an idea with merit. And now it's an idea that's a proven concept, and we're able to come before you and say it worked, and we would like to formalize that and make that a feature of our mental health care system. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Kevin McChesney, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Residential Providers Association. And I wanted to mention a couple of things. I mean, I think the need for housing of any type throughout the state is still overwhelming. And, you know, I think the $5 million, I don't know how many units it provided, but, you know, I really think that's just scratching the surface of the overall need. One of the things that's really changing the landscape a little bit is the settlement with the USDOJ in Oregon, and the limit that they're really saying, if you're going to provide housing for people with disabilities, that you can only designate up to 20% of the specific units in a development for people with disabilities. So what that really has created is the opportunity to do both housing for people with disabilities as well as affordable housing. And I wanted to also give you an example of one project that I was familiar with in terms of how we're leveraging these dollars and getting other investments involved in providing this housing. So I actually approached a broker that I knew who approached a developer and let them know of this opportunity that these funds were going to be awarded. As a result of that, they applied for funds from the City of Portland, urban renewal funding, and actually were granted those funds contingent upon receiving an award of the funds from the $5 million. Ultimately, the project came together. They received a $1.6 million award from that $5 million fund. And as a result, they will be developing a 40-unit apartment complex that will be managed and operated by Central City Concern. So a lot of partners came together to make that happen. I think they're also, you know, I think we made a dent somewhat in the need to provide housing for homeless people. There's a significant need for housing first projects that would bring homeless, give people an opportunity to move into housing and then connect for services. We're very appreciative of the continued investment in community mental health services.
Would this be for, are we talking about people who are homeless but also suffering from a mental disorder?
Mental disorders, substance use disorders, yeah, specifically.
And homeless as well.
And homeless, yeah. So there's, you know, chronic homeless individuals who are difficult to engage in services. And unless we have housing to move them into that's readily available, they're not going to engage in services. So this type of funding provides opportunities for those individuals as well. So now that we are expanding community mental health services, we really need to have places for people to live so that they can have ready access to the services that they need and really have a safe place to live, and that's what they can build the rest of their recovery on. Thank you.
Are there questions for these gentlemen? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. I'm honored to be a chief sponsor on this, and I know you've put a lot of work into it. I remember hearing about it a couple years ago, and it's great to see the direction it's gone. And it's one of four mental health bills that I'm bringing forward this time around. And one of the things I keep hearing is that when someone is coming out of acute crisis care, there's just so little in place to step down to. So the whole issue of discharge planning, where do people go, these are all different pieces of it. And I'm really excited about this bill. So thank you for taking the lead and championing this.
Well, I think we're going to also get a briefing, and maybe we may want to find a way to do it with our joint committees, a further briefing on the DOJ settlement so we could mm-hmm. introduce our committee to it. I don't know whether you're other members. We have a lot of overlap between
yeah.
the two.
Yeah.
Maybe you could join in that.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have one more witness signed up.
Actually, somebody just raised their hand in addition.
Okay, great.
Didn't sign up.
We have two more witnesses.
Correct. Chris Hoy and Patty O'Sullivan.
Oh, Patty's here.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Patty O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, 62 hospitals, 15 of which have acute care psychiatric units. I apologize for not signing up, Sandy. I very quickly want to say that we support this bill wholeheartedly. We're very excited to see things happening in the mental health world this session, and want to be a part of that. As such, we noticed the committee did not include a member of a hospital or an acute care psych unit, but the purpose of the bill was to keep people from coming into our hospitals and psych units. So we think we have some knowledge, skills, and ability on what that would look like, and want to offer our help to the committee. So we would like to include a member of to be somebody from a hospital, specifically one of the acute care psych units.
Are you going to offer an amendment to the bill?
I will do that. This mm-hmm. just kind of popped up late.
Representative Kitty Geyer, please.
Yep, we were going to all put our heads together and
yeah. And I haven't gotten to Chris. I didn't know he was the lead on this, so it just sort of popped up late. Just like I didn't sign up, I didn't get an amendment yet. So. Hopefully you'll be a patient with me. I'm new at this.
I'm going to be a patient.
Thank you. If there's any questions.
Okay.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. For the record, my name is Chris Hoy. I'm a captain with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, and I'm the Director of Community Corrections there. I'm also a resident of Representative Clem's district. I'm sorry he's not able to be here for this. I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 2825. In considering this bill, I appreciate that this concept brings an innovative approach to a reality that impacts so many of us. The issue of services and housing for people with mental illness is one that is near and dear to my heart, and I speak from both a personal and professional perspective on this issue today. Many years ago, when I was a freshman, just across the street at Willamette University, my mother developed the need for mental health services. Unfortunately, at that time, in the small coastal town I grew up in, there were virtually no services available. Her situation grew dire, and her need grew so great, she was soon hospitalized at Damish, and not long thereafter at the Oregon State Hospital. I remember the stigma of mental illness was so overwhelming that I would sneak away from my dorm room at Willamette to visit her at the hospital. Many friends and professors did not know where I was going. I was too embarrassed to tell anyone. And those visits were awful. She did not need to be at the hospital, but there were no other alternatives for her at that time. Sadly, she never left the hospital and died as a patient there. After graduating from Willamette, I was lucky enough to begin my career with the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office. During that time, I worked primarily in the jail, where I observed so many people with mental illness getting arrested for minor charges because local law enforcement had no other options available to deal with a person needing services but not warranting hospitalization. While working in the evenings in the middle of the night, we often had people who would come to the jail and ask to be booked in just so they would have a place to stay out of the wind and out of the rain. Many of these people were mentally ill. There were just no housing options available for people in that situation. Now, more than 26 years later, I still see similar issues. Many of our 3,500 community corrections clients in Clackamas County are mentally ill. I have one parole and probation officer whose only job is to supervise seriously mentally ill clients, but it's not enough. My colleagues around the state have even fewer resources available. We do have housing and community support in Clackamas, and we have a great relationship with our community mental health partners, but we need more. 3 years ago, we opened a 14-bed transition house for men with mental illness releasing from the Clackamas County Jail from prison. And we recently dedicated beds in our women's center for mentally ill women needing transition services. But these services are in the criminal justice system, a system not appropriate for people with high mental illness and low criminality. And but for their mental illness, they would not be in our system, and this must change. We need more resources to help accomplish what we know works. We know people with mental illness often struggle in traditional settings. This bill will help with that. We know that people with mental illness are more likely to intersect with the criminal justice system when they do not have adequate community support. I see it every day. We know that but for the mental illness, they would not come to the attention of police and they would not go to jail. We know that people with mental illness sometimes receive critical stabilization services in jail, but more often actually experience a degradation of their mental health while there. And we know that when a person with mental illness is in jail, they spend far more time than a person without a mental illness would on similar charges. This bill will help. Last year, over 14,000 people were booked into the Clackamas County Jail. Of those, almost 2,000, or 14%, received psychotropic medication, and over 400 were placed on suicide watch. I am told by our jail commander that the number of severely mentally ill people in jail approaches 20% of the population. And the percentage of those with some form of mental illness is over 50 and possibly as high as 75%. In addition, almost 7,500 individuals in the Clackamas County Jail were placed on substance abuse withdrawal protocol last year. I'm very pleased to report that a recent review of our community corrections clients in Clackamas County revealed that 47% of the people on a regular caseload now have medical coverage. This will have a huge impact on our ability to refer clients for services. I'm hoping to increase that number. We've come a long way in Oregon, whether it's the implementation of crisis intervention training, increased academy training for law enforcement, in working with individuals with mental illness, suspension of benefits rather than termination of benefits upon incarceration, or the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. But we need to do more. Jail beds are at a premium. This bill will help keep people with mental illness out of jail and in the community where they rightfully belong, and allow precious beds to be utilized for those who truly need incarceration. When I think back to my mother's situation almost 27 years in the corrections business, I know full well that she could have easily found herself intersecting with the criminal justice system instead of the mental health system. Sadly, so many of the families find themselves in that very situation. I urge you to support this bill and prevent that tragedy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Yes.
Thank you for coming and testifying again. I was in the Human Services Committee when you testified last time. I think you were in your public safety uniform, as I recall.
Could be.
So I didn't recognize you this time, but thank you for coming. And you bring up a really important aspect of it, and I believe that it's true that people who are incarcerated don't have access to the Oregon Health Plan. And so the medical care that they get there falls on the counties, whereas when they're out, if we had a place for them to be outside of that system where we could treat them, it's a huge benefit to us because they're on the Oregon Health Plan, which 60% of which is covered by federal dollars. So
they have access pre-adjudication.
But not when they're in. So, I mean, there's a financial aspect. Of course, we want them to get the services they need in the appropriate place, but there is also a financial savings to the state when we can be treating them outside of the prison system.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer, that's correct. The majority of the inmates, at least in the Clackamas County Jail, are post-adjudication. So that's that the money is coming directly from the county general fund.
Mm-hmm. Right. Big burden on the counties.
Yes, it is.
So. Mm-hmm. Okay. You got any amendments to this we can get?
The counties. Yeah. They don't have money.
Move it quickly to Ways and Means. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2825. Is there any other matters to be brought before the committee? Note, we're 25 minutes early on a Friday afternoon. We are adjourned. We are adjourned.